Yes, we are in the second week of a series called The End. So we're in the middle of the end. And last week, Jonathan, that's his Latin name, apparently. You can see him with little leaves in his ears. Jonathan, he started us into some really cool stuff. Great conversation stemmed from that last week. We even just had good conversation in the office about all that meant. And at home, Christy and I talking about some of the content. So really cool stuff. If you haven't listened, you can go back online to go to our website. You can subscribe via podcast to the message. This week, we're going to dive into some more stuff that really it's just fun for me. It's this one kind of goes out to the nerds. So if you really resonate, you don't have to maybe say that out loud, but a lot of this will go out to you. But this one also goes out to people who are just by nature, they're maybe dissidents. But it also, again, it goes out to people who, man, they're suffering. They're under trial. There's a difficulty. There's a difficulty in decisions. There's a heaviness in their life right now. And that they feel like they just want to give up. I'm done. I don't want to do this anymore. I give up. It's too hard. So it's going to be fun, but it's for all of those people today. And so we're going to dive in. We're going to spend a lot of time in the book of Revelation today. It's written by a man named John. We're not sure who this John character is. He might be the same John from the Gospel of John. Many people think that he's not, but just John of Patmos. He's exiled on the island of Patmos. And he's apparently stranded there. He's apparently not able to get off of the island and be with his brothers and sisters. And there's a lot of scholarship that says the reason he's there is because of his faith. The powers that be took him and detached him in the same way that it was like cutting the head off the animal. They thought if we can isolate him, this Christianity thing, it'll go away. So John is on Patmos, and he's exiled, he's banished, he's isolated, he's alone. And you need to know a couple things about John as you read this letter, because Revelation's weird. It just is. I'll say it. It's a weird, weird document. But John is very mindful of apocalyptic literature. He's very mindful of the prophetic literature and what we would now call the Old Testament. To him, it was his Bible and Daniel and Ezekiel. And so he's got a lot of that. But there's a couple other things to recognize about John as you're reading this. And that's that John has a foot in multiple worlds at the same time. See, John grew up as a Jewish boy. And so he's a Jew. If you would ask him, he'd say, I'm Jewish. I worship the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I come from the Jewish background. But at the same time, he's got his foot in something, a term maybe he never heard or used, but he's a Christian. See, he thinks that he's just what the Jews were getting to. He thinks he's the culmination of Judaism. But he's learning that this new thing is different, that God's Spirit is navigating, and that it's about a resurrected Messiah. It's about new beginnings. It's about something else that God has always been up to, but has now fully revealed that he's been up to in the person of Jesus. And so he's a Jewish man, but he's a Christian man. And then at the same time, he's starting to bump up against Greeks, that as God has called in Jews and Greeks and different people, he has friends he would have never had before. And so some of their views and some of the way they talk and they see things and science and poetry and literature, all of this stuff is coming together. And he's got a foot in each one of those worlds. But there's another world he's got his foot in. And this is the one that contradicts who he is. And this is the Roman world, the umbrella under which all of the other worlds seem to be existing in John's day. It's the Roman Empire. This one is absolutely an affront to his identity as a Jew, as a Christian, as a man of faith in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and of Jesus Christ. It absolutely goes against his grain. There's a lot of reasons that Rome would have been viewed this way. Rome is an empire. Rome is a system dedicated to existing under the ruler the rule of a single man, a single entity as power. Rome seems to be consumed with conquest, lust, hedonism, addiction to pleasure and comfort, violence and brutality. Rome seems to be addicted to making the borders of Rome expand all the way around the globe. It seems to be bent on creating a bigger and bigger and bigger gap between those who have and those who do not have. Poor people were less human than rich people in the eyes of Rome because they had never, ever considered what Genesis says in the Hebrew Bible, that human beings are made in the image of their creator. The Roman system is an absolute affront to the Jewish people. This is who wrote Revelation, and this is when he wrote it. Now, one of the biggest reasons, there's a lot of reasons, but one of the biggest reasons that Rome was seen this way by faithful Jews and Christians is something that it's almost silly to us now to consider this being a reality. But Caesar worship was a very central component of what it meant to be a citizen of Rome, that you would worship the Caesar. Now, for us, it's like, can you really imagine singing songs to and bowing down before a president or a king today? We would find ourselves too sophisticated. But this is a very sophisticated class of people who are bowing down and singing and worshiping the Caesars. Now, it seems to have started with Julius Caesar. When he dies, at the same time, there's a comet, and people say, hey, there goes a comet. And there are a group of people who say, well, of course a comet is going by when Julius Caesar dies. That is Julius Caesar going up into the heavens to take his spot at the right hand of God. And so when his family member came in, Octavius, who changed his name to Augustus, when he came into power as Caesar, he was referred to, and this predates the time of Jesus, he was referred to as the Son of God. You can find this outside the Bible, that Caesar Augustus is referred to as the Son of God, the Huios, Theos. Now, it's also interesting that in trying to keep the peace of Rome, which they called the whole world, to get world peace, they were dependent on the Son of God, whom they called Kyrios Kai Soter, Lord and Savior. The Son of God was the Lord and Savior of the world who was going to bring peace. Now, the way that he did it was by everybody that disagreed got nailed to a tree. People were killed. They would come in and say, Pax Romana, peace of Rome, and then hack off everybody's head and say, see how much better things are. That's the way he did it. But if you outside the Bible, you can find this. You can find this on columns. You can find this inscribed. You can find it on coins, on different papyrus, all these different ways that they actually began to change their calendar around the birth of Caesar, that they began to. There was a whole system of prayers and incense offerings that would go to the Caesar. So if you follow the lineage of the Caesars, you get to guys like Caligula. We won't get to Caligula today, but just go home and Google Caligula. This dude was nuts. He used to walk around dressed up like both a man and a woman in women's shoes, and then in Alexander the Great's breastplate. He dug up Alexander the Great's coffin and wore his breastplate around and was like, yeah, I'm the leader of the entire world. He's lost his marbles, and people are like, we got to bow down to this. This is the Son of God. Absolutely nuts. You get other guys that they were, as they came to power, very much as the years went on, persecuting Christians, making their lives very, very difficult as they set up these statues everywhere and demanded that we don't care what other faith. It's not that you can't have another faith, but you have to produce evidence of your loyalty to Rome by way of worshiping and making offerings to Caesar. Now, it got to the point that with these Caesars, they'd move around town it was hard to market yourself back then. You couldn't Twitter, you couldn't do all of those things. And so what they would do is they would have their image stamped on coins and on different certificates and columns and statues and that sort of thing. And it was a way of reinforcing all the time that Caesar is divine, that he is a god. And to control that, and in order to have mass control so that Rome had the stability as an empire under one person, the way that you would control that is that you weren't able to buy, sell, or trade unless your loyalty was proven. Now, in 250 AD, we have some actual archaeological evidence of this. There was a document called a libellum. This was a document that, and you can find this online, you would be given this piece of paper to show that you had made some sort of offering, some sort of public genuflecting, some kind of incense offering, something that says, I bow to the divinity in loyalty, in worship to Caesar. Now, the church obviously had a big problem with this. And so you can also find church writings that say you should excommunicate anybody that would do that. And then there's on the other side, what is it really worth giving your life for? I mean, we know he's not really God. Should we die? There's this whole debate that comes with that. But earlier, around the time that John writes Revelation, which is going to be somewhere between 50, 55 AD and maybe 80, right in that window, probably closer to the earlier side of that. Right in that window is when John of Patmos writes this. At this point in history, there's a lot of scholars that talk about this, that this campaign to make people believe that Caesar was in fact God and to control how they moved about within the kingdom, within the empire, that you can't buy, sell, or trade unless you take the kerygma. That's an empirical word for a stamp. That's a stamp on a coin. The image of Caesar, or the stamp on a document. It could be an ink stamp. It could be some kind of indentation that represented, that kerygma represented loyalty, the divinity of Caesar. You can find that term outside the Bible, and it's always in relation to the coinage or to official empire documents and that sort of thing. That you wouldn't be able, as somebody that made goods or provided services, you would not be able to provide for your family unless you were able to prove that, yes, I made an offering. Yes, I bow, I take a knee for the divinity of Caesar. I'm all in. Please let me have a life. Please let me eat. Please let me sell. Please let me make money. And so real live brothers and sisters of ours, thousands of years ago, really did ask this question. Am I going to take the mark? I mean, I know he's not God, but I'm going to die. My kids are not going to eat. Will I take the mark? Will I take the kerygma? Will I take that document and publicly say, yeah, I know I said I was a person that put my faith in God, but I mean, it's a real question. And I don't know if you put my three little kids on the line, I don't know how I would have answered that. Your brothers and your sisters ask that question on a day just like today. They wake up and say, I'm starving. I'm desperate. Am I going to take the kerygma? Am I going to do it? Knowing this is reality, I want you to hear John in Revelation chapter 13. I saw another beast coming out of the earth. He had two horns like a lamb, but he spoke like a dragon. He exercised all the authority of the first beast on his behalf and made the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast, whose fatal wound had been healed. Whose fatal wound had been healed. And he had performed great and miraculous signs, even causing fire to come down from heaven to earth in full view of men. Because of the signs he was given power to do on behalf of the first beast, he deceived the inhabitants of the earth. He ordered them to set up an image in honor of the beast, who was wounded by the sword and yet lived. He was given power to give breath to the image of the first beast, so that it could speak and cause all who refused to worship the image to be killed. He also forced everyone, small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a kerygma, is the term in Greek behind that English word mark, on his right hand or on his forehead, so that no one could buy or sell unless he had the kerygma, which is the name of the beast, or the number of his name. This calls for wisdom. If anyone has insight, let him calculate the number of the beast, for it is man's number. His number is 666. Anybody ever seen three sixes put together before? Yeah. Did you hear about this guy? He's from Bolivia. Just this last Wednesday, he hijacked a plane in Mexico City. Little cardboard box with blinky lights on it. Get me President Calderon. I need his attention. They grab him. It was an empty box with blinky lights. He said that he had gotten a message from God that there was going to be a great earthquake, and he wanted to warn the people of Mexico City. Well, where did you get this message? Because the date was the 9th of September 2009. He flipped the nines over, three sixes, and put together that this was his duty. Now, you may laugh at that, but when your order rings up to $6.66, you add gum. I just had a woman come to me first hour. She said, whenever she gets 666 emails deleted in her account, she starts deleting more. Like, so I think that's funny. We're I guess, not above that. Those numbers are, man, these are really powerful numbers. I mean, they really are. Those six, I mean, you can be completely irreligious, and that's worse than a 13 for a lot of us. That's a heavy number. What does that mean? Well, one of the things we have to understand is something that's called gematria. It's how the ancients played with numbers. There are people that still do this. The science of it is alive and well, but it used to really, really be something that everybody did. And it's how you play with numbers. Because both the Greek language and the Hebrew language, the letters of both the Greek and the Hebrew alphabets, they're also their numbers. And so there's power in the letters and so far as they represent numbers. Now, a couple of these show up over and over in the scriptures. 6 and 7 and 8 are really, really big. All of them from 1 through 10 pop up, and they have all these different symbolic meanings. And some of you may be familiar with some of that, but some of you maybe not. But 6 is what he even calls in Revelation, it's a man's number. The reason is because man was created on the 6th day. Man is imperfect, and so 6 represents imperfection. 6 always represents an imperfection or an evil or something shy of God. Anytime you repeat something 3 times for the Hebrew mind, you are really emphatically stating your case, so that 666 would be a way of really, with strength, saying imperfection, 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 evil. It's a mockery of the Trinity. It's a false Trinity. 7s always are wholeness. The creation week is, it took 7 weeks for it to be completed, and so it's always wholeness and completion and goodness. 7 comes up that way a lot. 8 is an interesting number because it's always associated with rebirth, something new, something resurrected. Noah, there were 8 people on the ark, and then they step off into a new world. Jesus resurrects on the first day of the week, and which is essentially the 8th day of the week. Something brand new had become. So Jesus shows his mastery over life and death itself by resurrecting on the first day of the next week, which is essentially, again, the 8th day. 8 is always about power and about new beginnings and strength, real, true strength in the 8. So this is what's going on. This and a whole lot of other symbols and that sort of thing going on with numbers in the minds of those that are reading this. Now, it gets even more interesting. As John is writing this, there is a Caesar in power. There is somebody running things. And right in the window that John writes this, Nero is the emperor. Now, if you look in Greek, this is Nero, by the way, who's got an awesome chin strap haircut. Like, I've almost got the guts to take this top part off because I think that's hot. And apparently he invented the mullet. He's empire in the front, party in the back. So this in the Greek language is Nero's name, Neron Caesar. So if you take this and turn each of those letters into their numeric equivalents, you get the number 1005. So Caesar Nero would have been like, well, big deal. I don't know what you're saying, but you're not talking about me, so you just sit on your island and say what you were saying. I don't care. But he says it takes wisdom, it takes some mental strength to really calculate what's going on, and you've got to remember who says this. It's a Jewish man saying this. If you take that and you transliterate it back into his native Hebrew language. Let me see if I can. It reads from left to right. This is what it would look like. Neron Caesar. Okay? This is what how it would have been said in the Hebrew language, which John would have been very familiar with. This is the language Jesus spoke and all the first apostles and all that. What's interesting now is because the Hebrew language, you can also do that's where gematria comes from. To give the numeric equivalence to all this, 260, 100, 56, 250. When you do the math, you get 666. You're supposed to go, ooh. Because once the original readers figured out what he was saying, which took a couple of degrees of really paying attention, suddenly they wanted to put the document down and go, this is dangerous. This is very, very dangerous. Now, St. Jerome translated the Latin Vulgate, translated the Bible into Latin. This is a couple hundred years later. And what he does is something very interesting, because many of us, we've grown up being aware of 666 being in the Bible. But for some of our Bibles, it's 616. Have any of you ever seen 616 in the Bible? And everyone, well, which one is it? Which number is it? Because it seems important. Jerome translates the Bible into Latin. In Latin, this is, his name would just be Nero Caesar. It's not Neron, it's Nero. There is no N. So Jerome apparently knew exactly who John was talking about. And so in Latin, you take this N off, which costs you 50 points. 666 minus 50 is 616. Jerome knows exactly who John's getting at. He had already figured it out. And so whether it's 666 or 616, depending on the language, they're both right. Is that awesome? That's awesome to me. I've already done this for a whole hour this morning and I still, yes. I think it's great. Okay. What do I got to do to wake you up? So this is the number of the beast. And the readers of this, the first time they see this, they're like, oh, wow. There's something really, really powerful being said to us right now. I mean, they're passing around, they're winking, they're not. Do you realize what John is saying? This very subversive thing that John is saying to us? Now, really interestingly, is Domitian is a Caesar a couple decades later, a couple generations of Caesars later. Domitian comes on the scene. Nero messed up as Caesar. And they decide to assassinate him, to kill him. He finds out. They know he's going to be grabbed, stuck on a fork, and beaten to death. He doesn't want that, so he takes out his sword, and he stabs himself in the throat and in the head, and he kills himself. No one ever found the body. It's very interesting, and it added to all kinds of speculation. Did he really die? So people saw him do it. People saw that he tried to kill himself. No one found the body. These rumors, you can read this again outside the Bible, rumors, the people began to speculate. He wounded his head, but he lives and he's coming back. Domitian picks up where Nero leaves off in terms of persecution of Christians. And people began to say, you can find this in a lot of documents, that Domitian was Nero. You actually have this picture right here of Domitian that is thought to be, this is actually in the Vatican, that's thought to be reworked from a statue of Nero. They believed it so much, they just took a statue of Nero and tweaked it and said, now it's Domitian. Now, the reason that that's so fascinating is because later on in Revelation, it reads this way. Revelation 17. The beast which you saw once was, now is not, and will come out of the abyss and go to his destruction. He was, and now he's not, but he will be again. The inhabitants of the earth whose names have not been written in the book of life from the creation of the world will be astonished when they see the beast, because he once was, now is not, and yet will come. And this calls for mind with wisdom. The seven heads are seven hills on which the woman sits. Rome was built on seven hills. So John gets a little too plain right here. He's making sure all his readers pick up what he's laying down. Rome was built on seven hills. And people began to say, the one beast's head suffered a wound, but miraculously lived in the next. Now, just for fun, Roman numerals. You guys are familiar with Roman numerals, yes? D, C, L, X, V, I. These all have numeric values. Not till the second century after the time of John on Patmos did they come up with the M to represent 1,000. They would just put a line over the numerals to say times 1,000. So it was 100 years after this that they began to use M for 1,000. So this was 500, C was 100, L was 50, X was 10, V was 5, and I was 1. I'll let you do the math. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I felt that too. Caesar, Rome, the empire. It's evil, 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 says John. It's a beast. It's against God. It's everything God is not. Even though it's running the world, it has no goodness in it, according to John. And he's alerting his readers to be aware. The beast for John is Caesar / Rome. This false trinity, this mockery, God or Jesus throughout Revelation says, I'm the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last. And I think it's interesting that if you take the last to the first in their numeric system, the Roman numeric system, you get a counterfeit Omega Alpha, a backward Christ. You get this backward, counterfeit, false God. Alert, 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 alert. It's fascinating. Now, this raises questions for us about the Antichrist. Is this the Antichrist? How are we going to recognize the Antichrist? There are people in this room that you've asked that question in the last week. What is the Antichrist actually going to look like? Will he have horns or will she have long hair? Who is the Antichrist and how are we going to know? And look, the number, the 666, the Antichrist, the speculation is a very conservative term. Barcodes have been the mark of the beast. The Pope has been the Antichrist. Ronald Wilson Reagan has been the Antichrist and the beast. There's been so many different speculations on both sides of what is this mark and who is the Antichrist. But what's interesting is Antichrist never shows up in Revelation. That word is not used in Revelation. A lot of us would assume that it was. It's not there. Antichrist only gets used 5 times in the scriptures. 4 of them come from this little tiny letter in the back of the Bibles, 1 John. And the other one comes from 2 John. It's even smaller. It's like an index card he sent. It was a postcard he sent to his friends. And it uses that on there. And what's interesting is he uses it plurally. Listen to how he uses it in 1 John chapter 2. Don't love the world or anything in the world. Stop. This is the same Bible where Jesus says God so loved the world that he gave his one and only son. So it doesn't mean hate the world. Don't, you know, go live in a cave somewhere. It means what you give primacy to. What is your priority? What leads you? What draws you in? What do you fear and bow down to? Don't love the world or anything in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father isn't in him. For everything in the world, the cravings of sinful man, the lust of his eyes and the boasting of what he has and does, this all comes not from the Father, but from the world. The world and its desires, superficial desires, desires isn't the issue. It's the wrong ones. They're going to pass away. But the man who does the will of God lives forever. Dear children, this is the last hour. And he doesn't really think it's the last hour because he assumes that somebody's going to read this. And as you have heard that the Antichrist is coming, even now many Antichrists have come. This is how we know it's the last hour. They went out from us, but they didn't really belong to us. For if they belonged to us, they would have remained with us. But their going showed that none of them belonged to us. But you have an anointing from the Holy One. And all of you know the truth. It's like this: these people, they were with us. They were part of us. And then you know what they said? I don't want to do this anymore. It's too hard. I mean, what's the difference, really? Really, what does this do? John? Life used to be a lot easier. What difference really do my decisions make? Especially the ones I make in private. And John says, that's Antichrist. That's completely different than Christ. That's opposite of Christ. That's anti-Christ. To just say, what difference does that make? I'm going this way. I'm going to go with everybody else because you know what? I'm tired of swimming upstream. This is easier. This is just easier. See, the danger in trying to figure out who the one Antichrist is, the danger in doing that, I think, is that you're going to miss out on the actual point that's way more significant, way deeper. And it's this, that it's not just Nero, not Domitian, it's not just Rome. It's something that happens right in front of you. It's something that can happen inside of you. Many of us, we're still trying to figure out, is it barcodes? Is it the social security number? Is it this person? Is it that person? And John is saying, you're going to miss it. You're going to miss it. If you look only out there, you're going to miss it. Now, when he said that it takes wisdom and understanding to calculate the number of the beast, the number of his name. He says it takes wisdom, it takes understanding. If you're a Jewish man or woman reading this, what's the first thing you think of when you think of wisdom? Wisdom. Who do I associate with wisdom? Solomon. King Solomon. Remember, he asked God. He was allowed to ask God for anything. He said, I want wisdom. And God said, I'm going to give you that. You could have asked me for stuff, but you asked me for wisdom. So I'm going to give you wisdom and stuff. Just trust me. You're going to do really, really well. We find out in 1 Kings chapter 10 that he's doing really, really well. People are coming to him with wisdom, but he is starting to amass all kinds of wealth and power. And those things aren't bad because God said, I want you to have them. I want you to have wealth. I want you to have power. I want you to have strength and be a good leader. I'm giving you leadership. I want to give you influence. I'm going to give you resources. You get to a point, though, where something shifts for Solomon. And we think of Solomon as a hero. And so this might surprise some of us. But you get to this point, the queen of Sheba comes. She has heard that Solomon is just brilliant and he's loaded and he's really got himself put together. So she shows up with her entourage and all this stuff. And she starts quizzing him. And he's just blowing her mind with his answers. And she gets to a point, she's like, I didn't have half the story on you. You are brilliant. You have blown my mind. You're absolutely brilliant. And you are what? Praise to your God, she says. It's interesting, Solomon never says that about himself. He's silent through the whole thing in 1 Kings 10. He doesn't say a word. He doesn't deflect and say, well, actually, God gave me this. He's just, yeah, I'm kind of hot too. Over and over and over. And then we get to this point. It's fascinating to me. In 1 Kings chapter 10, King Solomon gave the queen of Sheba all she desired and asked for, besides what he had given her out of his royal bounty. Then she left and returned with her retinue to her own country. The weight of the gold that Solomon received yearly was 666 talents. If you keep reading in the very next couple sentences, it says, plus everything else that he had coming in. But the author doesn't add it all together for you. He separates out to make sure he can say to you 666 plus more. Because he's trying to make a statement that goes well beyond measurement. And then from there, you start to find out that his chief goals are conquest and power in his own name. He builds armaments. He has to take an entire city and make it the storehouse of his chariots. This whole city stores horses. This whole city is for this. And this empire starts to grow where it's all about him. It's all about power. It's all about that. And then you get to 1 Kings 11. Just a couple sentences later, King Solomon, however, loved many foreign women besides Pharaoh's daughter, Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites. They were from nations about which the Lord said, don't intermarry with them. They're going to surely turn your hearts after their gods. Nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them in love. He had 700 wives of royal birth and 300 concubines on the side, and his wives led him astray. Wise, gentlemen, this is the wisest man on the planet. Thought this was a good idea. Can you imagine what the holidays were like? Next slide. Solomon grew old. His wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart wasn't fully devoted to the Lord his God as the heart of David, his father, had been. He followed Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. Molech was the god that demanded, according to the legends, that you offer your child on a burning altar. Here's how much I love you, Molech, since you demand that my child be incinerated in front of me. Detestable in the eyes of God. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He didn't follow the Lord completely as David, his father, had done. I'm fascinated that the sixes are first attributed to the king of the Jews back then, the king of Israel. Evil, evil, evil. Something shifted, and from there we get a conquest for lust and power and greed. And he starts surrounding himself with things that are dragging him away from God, that drag him away from true love. He starts to settle step by step by step. He's letting go of what he had been invited into. Step by step by step, he's letting go. And see, John of Patmos, he's saying, hey, this takes wisdom. This takes understanding. I'm not just talking about these guys. You guys have seen, you guys have heard and read about this before. This is not just some futuristic, mysterious thing that'll happen somewhere else while we're all hiding in here. This is something that's potentially inside all of us. This can happen right in front of you. This can happen within you. We've seen it before. See, for John, it happened before. It was happening while he wrote it, and he knew it was going to happen again. So Revelation isn't about something that happened or something that will happen. Revelation is about something that happens. It's about something that continues to happen, because every one of us inside asks the question, in your own words, you ask this question: am I going to take the mark? Am I going to give in and just take the mark? I mean, does it really matter? Does that stuff matter? Do my choices, does my purity, my integrity, does what I do in private or what I say to people I don't really have a relationship with, does my consistency, does my courage or what I choose to fear or how I let fear govern my life, my soul, whatever that is, my faith, does any of that stuff really matter? I mean, I get going to church and having values and probably don't use this word anymore, and your kids should probably come up in a positive environment. I get all of that, but really, does it matter? Shouldn't I just give in and take the mark? Because I'm tired. And so I'll just take the mark. I'll take the mark of greed. I'll take the mark of lust. I'll take the mark of cynicism. I'll take the mark of deceit. I'll take the mark of envy. I'll take the mark of bitterness. I'll take the mark of rage. Does it really matter? Because it's just so hard. And John, isolated on Patmos, in the center of the most difficult time in his life, says, don't give in. Don't give in. Don't give up. Don't give up. Don't give up. It does matter. My dear brothers and sisters, it does matter. Don't give in. And he writes this in Revelation chapter 7. I looked, and there before me was a great multitude that nobody could count, from every nation, every tribe, every people, every language, standing before the throne and in front of the Lamb. They were wearing white robes and were holding palm branches in their hands, and they cried out in a loud voice, "Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." And all the angels were standing around the throne and around the elders and the four living creatures, and they fell down on their faces before the throne and worshiped God, saying, "Amen, praise and glory and wisdom and thanks and honor and power and strength be to our God forever and ever. Amen." Then one of the elders asked me, "These in white robes, John, who are they? And where did they come from?" And I answered, "Sir, you know if anybody does." And he said, "These are they who have come out of the great difficulty, the great tribulation. They've washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore, they are before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple. And he who sits on the throne will spread his tent of protection over them. Never again will they hunger, never again will they thirst. The sun will not beat upon them, nor any scorching heat. For the Lamb at the center of the throne will be their shepherd. He will lead them to springs of living water, and God will wipe away every tear from their eye." John is seeing this, and he's got the difficulties and the tribulations and the oppression and the persecution and even the apathy and the pain of his brothers and sisters in mind. And he says, "I've seen the throne. I've seen the throne, and I can't fully explain it to you, but Nero and Domitian and Rome, they're not on it. I've seen the throne, and they're not on it. The Lamb is. I've seen the throne, and your appetites and those empty lusts that just follow you around all the time, and the lies in your head and your insecurities and those fears and your past hurts and everything you think you're incapable of doing, and those superficial wants and desires and those empty promises that were made to you, those empty pursuits that keep leading you nowhere but you continue to pursue them. I've seen the throne, and those aren't on the throne. They don't rule either. I've seen the throne, and it's not Nero. And it's not that junk. It's the Lamb. And it's worth it. Jesus is worth it. He is on the throne. I've seen it." From the center of difficulty, John of Patmos says, don't give in. Brothers and sisters, don't give in. Don't give up. Don't let go. Hang in there. I've seen the throne. I've seen who reigns. I've seen who wins. And it's nothing that you've been told. It's worth it. It's worth it. It's worth it. Declare it as a people that all power and glory and honor and thanks and wisdom, they go to the Lamb. Not all the other things that you have seen and been told are worth bowing down to. I know it makes sense. I know that's the way everything seems to be sweeping. But salvation doesn't come the way you think. Salvation isn't coming the way you've been told. It's Jesus. Don't let go. Don't let go. Don't let go. Don't give up. Wherever you are, whatever's crushing you, whatever you're trying to wriggle out from underneath, all the ways that you say, but I have to do this or I am going to lose my life. I'm going to lose my house. I'm going to lose this. This is the minimum I have to do to keep my standing socially. This is the minimum I have to do to keep any sense of happiness and pleasure in my life. This is the minimum I'm going to have to do to keep those away from me that have angered me or have wronged me. I have to do these things. I have to take these marks. I have to make concessions. I have to give in here and here and here. And it doesn't seem like a big deal, but it's going to immediately be helpful. And John says, don't do it. I've seen the throne, and that stuff's not on the throne. The Lamb is worthy to be praised. Hang in there and do not let go. I know difficulty and pain and even apathy make you want to compromise. I know when you look around and everything just seems to be sweeping that way, and after 10 years of it being sweeped that way, really to go back the other way, it's old-fashioned, it's unintelligent. Don't let go, because I've seen the throne, and guess what? Despite all appearances, Jesus reigns. I've seen the throne, and there's a Lamb in it. Jesus reigns. I want to invite you to stand up, and I mean this sincerely. I want to invite you to do something cosmically subversive. Stand up. Cosmically subversive. Because I want to invite you to come together in the best way you know how, where regardless of where you are in this journey of faith, the best that you know how, to link your heart with the person next to you, to link yourself to this community, and to understand that Jesus reigns. There's nothing else that reigns. There's nothing else that holds sway. There's nothing else in that throne but Christ Himself. Christ is the new beginning. Christ is the resurrection. Christ Himself, Jesus, is the beginning of a new day for each and every one of us.